Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkar, and more importantly, I have the pleasure of welcoming back to the podcast today, Dr. Gavin Flood, who's professor of Hindu studies and comparative religion at Oxford University. He's also heavily involved in some work at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, which we'll touch on. He's recently finished a fascinating new work on Tantra, which we'll dive into. Gavin, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks very much, Raj. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, you know, this little thing called Tantra and the various connotations and understandings and misunderstandings thereof, I think it's a great topic to do a proper study on. Could you maybe say a little bit about your interest, the work, you know, tell us a bit about your journey studying this?
Well, I could talk about the new book for a bit, if you like. There's it came out of a course, an Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies course, CED, Continuing Education course, which is at ochsonline.org, if you're interested. And we have a publishing series called Mandala Publishing Series, and we've decided to try to turn courses into books for sort of popular consumption. So that's what the book is. So Tantric Knowledge, Philosophy, History, Practice. I don't think of it so much as an academic book, but as an accessible, as a readable book for people, the general audience, for people who are interested, who aren't necessarily scholars, but to people who are interested in the topic. Now, Raj's earlier question, my own journey, if you like, into this topic, it started when I was an undergraduate, really, and then I started when I was a postgraduate student at Lancaster University. I heard a lecture by Alexis Samson. He came up and gave a lecture to us, and I thought, oh, that's what I'm interested in. So I shifted my PhD topic into Shaivism, and I got interested in other things as well, of course, along the way. But so that's the roots or the origins of my interest. And since then, it's become, well, because of the work of Alexis and his students, we now know the complexity of the history. And so it's made me think more about what is Tantra and how does it fit in? And so this book is really a product of that thinking.
Yeah, fascinating. As listeners will know, we've touched a couple of times on the OCHS and the continuing studies work. I'm of course biased in that I quite enjoy teaching continuing studies, particularly at the OCHS. And I really, you know, much akin to the enterprise of New Books Network and these podcasts, I really appreciate the impulse to render accessible rigorous scholarly insight. So that wonderful sweet spot between something being well researched and well thought through, but also not being so opaque that interested lay people can't follow along. So I quite love the enterprise of turning continuing studies course materials into publications. And I think more and more, at least in my experience hosting this podcast, more and more I think scholars are learning to write accessibly for obvious reasons.
I completely agree. There's no point in writing books that nobody reads. You want people to read your work, so you have to write clearly as you can anyway. So I hope I've succeeded in that in this new...
I've actually looked at the course book, and without question, you have. Do you want to say a little bit about the structure of the course book?
Certainly. Well, there's an introductory chapter which lays out some of the issues and the problems. It says out what the word means, where it comes from, and some hypothetical reflection on the origin of Tantra. I don't really go into that too much because the origins, I think, were so difficult. I'll start again. The structure of the book is first introductory material, which I'll go back to in a minute. Second is on the Shaiva Siddhanta. The Shaiva Siddhanta is the central tantric tradition, if you like, in Indian civilization up until about the 13th century. It wasn't the only Shaivism around, but it provided the central ritual template, if you like. And then after that, you've got the non-dual Shaiva traditions responding to that and drawing from it. And then I look at Tantrism in Tantra in the land of Vishnu, where the Vaishnava appropriation of the Tantric model and the Tantric revelation in Vaishnavism. So I look at that, and then we move on through history. So it's a historical account beginning in about the 7th century, moving right the way through to the present day, really. And the last chapter is on Tantra outside of India, in Nepal, Southeast Asia, Bali, and Neo-Tantra, what we might call Neo-Tantra, the Tantra that we have inherited in the West, and its relation to the original civilization that Tantrism was.
Regarding this subtitle of the work, A New Understanding, say a bit more about that.
I think that, I hadn't noticed that actually, but yes, okay, A New Understanding is... The new understanding, I think, is that Neo-Tantra and traditional Tantra, let's call it that, are distinct entities, and that originally, from the 7th to the 13th century, Alexis Sanderson has called this the Shaiva Age. Now, we might well want to call it the Tantric Age, because Tantrism, it seems to me, was a whole civilization. It's based on these texts called Tantras, which are regarded as revelation from a higher power, from God, from Shiva, or from Shakti, from the goddess. And so there was an esoteric dimension to it, but it was mainstream religion, if you like, and it had patronage from royalty, from kings. So it was a form of religion and practice that permeated all levels of society, from the very highest with royal patronage to the common practice of ordinary people, such as protection from possession, rites of exorcism, and so on. Now, I think this is important because it seems, if this is a new understanding, then the new understanding is that its state, this is derived from the work of Alexis and others, that it's state-sponsored religion. And so it's mainstream sacrificial religion, focus on the king and his family, and for the protection of the state and for the prosperity of the state. And by the 13th century, these Tantric kingdoms are in decline, and you have the rise of the Delhi Sultanate. And so Tantrism, a state-sponsored religion, goes into abeyance, and it kind of goes underground. And so it re-emerges in the Sahajiya tradition in Bengal and so on, where it's decoupled from state sponsorship. So it becomes more esoteric, and I think it really loses the intensity and the richness of its original civilizational form. So we had at that period, we have Tantric temples, we've got Tantric art, Tantric sculpture, and all that disappears really, I think, by about the 13th century. Well, in the richness that it was. Well, of course, we get Tantric art through to the 18th century and even to the 19th and possibly 20th as well. So I think that's the essence of the idea of the new understanding, is that these traditions, which we think of perhaps as esoteric and secretive, were civilizational and state-sponsored.
That's a fascinating notion. So regarding this quote-unquote Tantric Age, and the state-sponsored religiosity, would you say that this was popular on the level of rulership on behalf of the kings and royal patronage, or would you say that this was actually popular among the populace itself?
I think both. I think it was state-sponsored. The kings were very attracted by this, and it was also sacrificial. As in Nepal, I mean, in a sense, Nepal preserved up until 2008, when they kicked out the monarchy, preserved a kind of Tantric kingdom, a state-sponsored Tantric kingdom right up until 2008. So it was indeed attractive to rulers who were interested in power. And it was easy for them. Shaivism was easy for them. All they had to do was get initiated, pay enough money to the guru, get initiated. That ensured their liberation and protection, if you like. So there are certain kinds of people that don't need the arduous practice of the Shaiva Siddhanta tradition of worship three times a day. You just need initiation. Women, kings, people without the mental capacity could just receive initiation without having to go through the arduous process of ritual in order to gain liberation at death. Now, the kings were attracted by this, and also, but they were also attracted by the non-dual tantric traditions. By non-dual, I mean those traditions which did not distinguish between pure and impure substances in ritual. So these were transgressive, and the kings were attracted by the transgression of these cults, if you like, coming from the cremation ground of the Karpalikas, because they thought they were powerful and gave them magical protection against enemies, and also helped in defeat enemies as well. So there was the six magical rites, the magical rites of protection and the destruction of enemies were attractive to these kings and these kingdoms. But it's also attractive to people at a popular level. So the nature tantra, for example, of which me and my colleague Bjarne Wernicke Olsen, we've just done an edition and translation in of the first volume, which will come out soon. And there, we've got several chapters on protection from possession by demonic beings, by yoginis and other buddhas, pishachas, various other beings, but particularly these female deities, yoginis, who, if you've got trouble in your life, it's because you've been possessed by a yogini, or if your child's sick, it could be possession by a yogini. This was in an early day before what we understand of as medicine had developed. And so you employ a mantrin who will give you a mantra to protect your kid or to ensure you get a good marriage for your children or whatever it is. So, and it's significant that the nature tantra was very popular in the Kashmir Valley, popular in Nepal, but it pervades all levels of society. So it's for ordinary people, but it's also for wealthy people too. So one of the rituals is you get a pot, you fill it with jewels, and then you pour water into it, sacred water. So to fill it with jewels, you have to be fairly well healed to do that. And it was copied by his fellow Kirti Dara for Abhayamala, the king of Nepal, in the spring of 1200. He dates it at the back. And it was probably copied because the king was sick or his son was sick, Arimala or Abhayamala. So it was copied for their protection. So that's very interesting that that text pervades all levels of the society, from the lowest common mantric practice right up to the kings. And also we might add that there's a philosophical dimension to this too. So the nature tantra contains what we might call a pre-philosophical understanding of the world, and which is picked up by philosophers such as Kshemaraja, who was a non-dualistic philosopher in Kashmir, who wrote a commentary on it. And that's very interesting because Kshemaraja, he's reading the nature tantra, commenting on it, and he's got both versions. He's got the Kashmir version and the Nepalese version in front of him, because sometimes he opts for different readings. So that's very interesting that he should sometimes choose the Nepalese version, which is slightly different in places. And it's probably the older one. Anyway, sorry, I went off on a bit of a tangent there. But yes, so tantrism pervaded all levels of society. It was very attractive to kings, but also attractive to ordinary people.
Tangents are features, not bugs, insofar as my questions are always meant to be generative. And so, and also, for the record, purposefully naive so as to perhaps echo questions on behalf of the audience. So to the best of our knowledge, when does Tantra emerge or take hold, and do we have a sense of its origins at all?
Yes, the earliest text is the Nishvasa Tattva Samhita, which was composed mostly in the 7th century, but elements of it go back to the 5th. So that's the earliest tantra that we possess, going rooted in the 5th century, which is very early indeed. And that comes out of ascetic traditions that in Alexis typology who called themselves the Atimarga, the higher path, because they thought that they transcended the Vedic structure of the four stages of life. This was the 5th stage, the higher path, or the outer path, the Atimarga. And these were ascetics who called themselves Pashupatas also. There were different groups within the Atimarga. The Pashupatas were ascetic groups who had their own scriptures, and the earliest tantras come out of these groups, but with the differences that they're for householders too. So I imagine that there are ascetics who are doing various practices, who see themselves as transcending the Veda, and who are producing in due course these texts that call themselves tantras, which have become adapted to householder life. So I think the literary origins, if you like, are in the Pashupatas, and also the Nishvasa Tattva Sanghita, the earliest text of the Shaiva Siddhanta, has its roots in ascetic groups or semi-ascetic groups who were householders as well. And as time went on, these texts proliferated, and there was a great sort of outpouring of these tantras from the 7th to the 10th century, really. Now, that's the literate answer. But there's another dimension to this, in that in later tantric texts of the non-dualistic tradition, you have transgressive texts coming along in what is called the Kula Marga, the path of the goddess. So you have I'm being a bit incoherent. So you have three paths, if you like: the Atimarga of ascetics, the higher path and superior path; the Mantramarga, the path of mantras, which was the householder tantric religion, which the kings were attracted to, of which the Nishvasa is a part, the earliest tantra that we have; and you have the Kula Marga, the path of the goddess or the family of goddesses. And those tantras are transgressive, which means that they think that you become liberated through the goddess, through the path of the goddess. And these transgressive texts advocated what they called melapa or melaka, which was a kind of ritual of a sexual rite, really, a collective sex. Sounds like a Oxford undergraduate party. But these were texts which were transgressive of orthodox norms. And now, what's the origin of this? Hindu traditions, Hindu worship is individualistic. So where's this coming from, this collective orgiastic worship? And it could be coming from tribal traditions, tribal religions, but there's no evidence for that. That remains pure speculation. But I think it's that the origins of that are very deep rooted and go back into prehistory, perhaps, where you have kapalas, cults to do with skulls, going back into the ancient past, and they're attested from I'll be careful of getting my facts right here, but they're attested from prehistoric times of people using skulls to drink out of. There was a book by Weston Labar many, many years ago called The Ghost Dance, in which he speculates about ancient prehistoric religion being focused on skulls and kapala. So the skål in Scandinavian languages means cup, and a kapala is the word kapala, skull in Sanskrit, is cognate with the English word cup. So there's something about skulls and cups which is very ancient. And I think that I wouldn't like to speculate more than that, but I suspect the skull cult and the sex cult, if you like, fertility cult, could come from tribal religions, could be very, very ancient before that, but become incorporated into literary tradition in about the the 7th to 10th century.
Fascinating. Thank you. Thank you for sharing some conjecture, some really useful speculation. No, my one of my primary academic interests is the Devi Mahatmya, and I focus primarily on the world within the text, so to speak, the literary dimension, the ring composition, the structure, just to really get a sense of, you know, how tradition is hoping we would interpret it by virtue of its structure, much as the Mahabharata, the Ramayana. But, you know, clearly the from the perspective of the history of religions, the Indic subcontinent, the text now is very much in vogue in tantric circles. And to my mind, that was an evolution or even an appropriation. But really, when I pay careful attention to the narrative world of the Devi Mahatmya, there are tantric themes left, right, and center. And so I've really come to suspect that, and now that you say that we've got textual evidence from as early as the 5th century, and the Devi Mahatmya is variously dated, somewhere between the 5th to 8th century, depending, you know, that's like all things Indic, it's fraught with debate, dating of the text. But it seems to my mind that there is some sort of code, symbolic, tantric expression occurring within the text. And the fact that, look, people didn't wake up 15 centuries ago and say, hey, let's worship a great goddess. There were no shortage of avenues of worship and religiosity. And this must be from ancient times where, you know, prior to the onset of sort of an Indo-European motif. I mean, people would not be able to unsee the power of the feminine, the fact that we come from a feminine body. And I don't think it's outlandish to imagine that the Devi Mahatmya is people were worshiping the goddess for centuries, if not millennia. And it was so popular, they gave her a Sanskrit text. But there are all these fascinating tantric themes in the text that are just mind-boggling. And so I'm actually really intrigued to hear your conjecture on the origins of Tantra. Now, so what's the appeal? Well, there are no shortage of paths and ideas. And I think you mentioned this in passing, and I think there's much to be said. So is the appeal this connection to the subtle, this sort of pseudo-sorcery, the magic, the Shakti, the power? Is Tantra, what is the work of Tantra? Is it offering a cure to ailments in itself is suggesting exist? Is it, you know, why all of a sudden would people be interested in this quite distinct and in some ways subversive path?
Indeed, that's a fascinating question. Just before I answer that, just a point about the Devi Mahatmya. I think that's really interesting, and there could well be tantric elements in it. And you've raised an interesting question on the relationship between what we might call Shaktism and tantrism. And Bjarne, my friend, has written on this. But there was in the 1930s, there was a scholar, a German scholar called von Glasenapp, and he wrote an important article on tantrism and Shaktism, in which he argued that they were distinct, and that Shaktism is an older kind of entity, if you like, that goes back deep into the past and worship of the goddess, if you like. But tantrism is a more literary kind of layer of culture that has appropriated and absorbs the Shakta traditions within it. I think there's probably, he was writing that in 1935. So, I mean, I think that's quite insightful for the time. And that links in with what you said about the ancient nature of the goddess. And I think that's correct, it seems to me. Now, as to regard the appeal of tantrism, the appeal in the medieval times was the power that it offered, and it was the new religion, the new kid on the block, if you like, and it was very attractive at all levels of society. Now, why that was, I imagine that kings were interested because of the issue of power. People were interested because they wanted something which went beyond Brahmanism, if you like, which was not restricted to a small social group, but was had much wider popular appeal. And in a sense, that question is, why are people attracted to religions in a way, and especially new religions, why when they come along? And I suspect it's to do with our proclivity as human beings towards something beyond ourselves, a desire for something beyond ourselves. Schleiermacher, who was a Christian theologian in the 19th century, defined religion as, about 1830 or perhaps even earlier, as longing for the infinite, longing for the infinite. So I think I've got some sympathy with that view. It's probably not a popular view, but it's kind of romanticism too. So I suspect that's one of the reasons why people are attracted to tantric traditions, because they offer something new. And in the post-war era, they offer something which there's a perception of old religion being stuffy and repressive. And here we've got something new and fresh, which is saying, actually, you don't have to be inhibited. You don't have to be repressed to be enlightened, if you like, or to experience some higher level of awareness. So I think it's a complex question, but a number of things come together. A focus, post-war focus on the notion of consciousness, I think, that was one reason for the attraction towards tantrism in the West. The focus on sex, people thought you were attracted by that, in contrast to, say, Catholicism, which had been repressive of sex. And possibly attraction to power as well. So probably a combination of those things, I suspect, attracts people to the tantric traditions.
You know, although, what you said, please continue.
Yeah, no, you carry on, Raj.
No, what you said a moment ago about this perhaps sweeping and romantic definition of a longing of the infinite, I don't find that outlandish or irrelevant, because, you know, do we know of a religious tradition that doesn't posit an ideation upon something along the lines of forever and ever, amen, or the other of the temporal, right? Something transtemporal. I mean, yeah. I don't think that's outlandish at all, and I think there's something to be said about that. That religiosity on some level pertains to or posits a dimension of reality in self that transcends the temporal, because of course we're bound by the temporal. So how can we know one without the other? And I like that actual overarching definition. And then my mind sort of plays with the idea of, well, tantra very much is attractive because, you know, it sort of swings the other way, where it's an amelioration of the finite. It's life in the world, protection and power and prominence in the world somehow, and there seems to be this indelible world affirmation that, along with Puranic Hinduism, really swings the other way from Upanishadic Hinduism. Would you say?
Yeah, I think that's great what you've just said. I agree with what you've just described. And the other thing is interesting is the you know, it's life affirming, but it's also saying that to affirm life, to affirm that which is beyond time, if you like, you have to come to terms with death as well. So this is, I mean, death is central to the tantric traditions and the goddess in particular. So Kali is the goddess covered in heads, and the Kapalikas are the ascetics with skulls. So they're trying to address death, and it's about the transcendence of death as well, and the affirmation of life, or the going beyond these binaries of living and dying, maybe something like that. But that's I think I agree with what you've just said there, and I'm a bit of a perennial philosopher, I suppose, in the sense that if you've got these, I've just done something, I've written something, it's called Naming Invisible Light, A History and Phenomenology of Holiness. Now, I think the basic idea of that is that you've got, here we are in the world in time, and human beings have, there are appearances to human awareness through history, which are appearances of the holy, if you like, we might call it that. Now, what is that? They're cultural forms that point to the inexhaustible. A colleague of mine, Paul Fiddes, calls it the inexhaustible, or the more. He also calls it the more or the inexhaustible. So you have cultural forms that are historically rooted, which change through history, but which nevertheless are pointing to something beyond themselves, pointing to something beyond ourselves, which we might call the inexhaustible. And that inexhaustibility, that those cultural forms correspond to something within us as human beings, as human persons, which I mentioned earlier, Schleiermacher called the longing for the infinite. So an innate desire within us for something beyond ourselves, which meets in these cultural forms, if you like, which are transition points between human history and that which is beyond history.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating, and I think there's a reason why we see patterns of proclivity and behavior across historical horizons and cultural iterations. Patterns, pulls towards art, pulls towards seeking, spiritual seeking, pulls towards et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And human beings are fundamentally mysterious, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
Fundamentally, yeah. And fundamentally. For us to, I mean, even on the level of scientific materialism, we're fundamentally mysterious. We haven't cracked the code of, you know, how is it that we are aware? What is awareness? You know, this always seems to be implicated in philosophical, spiritual discourses on meaning, on being, on to adopt an Indic paradigm on chitta or consciousness or awareness or the invisible light. And I think even light in a physical sense carries with it a really profound analog or metaphor of having this dual citizenship of being both particle and wave. And I think human beings, I mean, we of course we're discrete and individual. Of course you've got your path and I mine, et cetera, et cetera. And yet there are certain states and there are certain experiences where we function more as a wave. And I think it's fascinating to deliberate on this. And we certainly need to cover that book on the podcast as well when it's out. Regarding this new Mandala Tantra publication, tell us maybe a little bit about the context that you mentioned in passing at the outset, the CED context and what's happening at the OCHS, in case there are listeners who might be interested in benefiting from it.
Oh, yeah, well, at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies for many years now, run by Lal Krishna, we have a continuing education department, if you like, and we offer many, many interesting courses over the years, and they're still ongoing. And we've done Bhagavad Gita, we've done Understanding Tantra, we've done philosophy courses, we've done many yoga, we also have introductions to Sanskrit, all available. And Raj, you've done one as well, if I remember.
Devi Mahatmya.
The Devi Mahatmya, there we are, that's right, Raj did one on the Devi Mahatmya. So these are really, really high quality courses, which are intended to be accessible for everybody, and they're online on the you get a book, about 70,000 word course book, and you get a series of lectures, 8 lectures that you listen to, and there's also live interaction with the tutor for the period of the course, of the 8 to 10 weeks of the course. And you have an option of writing an essay or not. So I would encourage you to explore that, ochsonline.org.
Absolutely. And many of the listeners may be aware, I'm actually a tutor at the OCHS. I tutor a course on Hindu philosophy, Vedanta and Sankhya. What else? On the Puranas, on the Mahabharata. And so there are a number of...
Yes, Raj is the only thing with us, yeah.
There are a number of fine colleagues, such as Professor Flood, who you have access to. So it really is a really brilliant setup. Really appreciate. Well, why am I there? Why am I there? Because, you know, the OCHS's work really aligns with my own, which is rendering accessible the fruits of our scholarly labor, so no one is left out of the discussion who are interested. So definitely check it out if you're interested. Gavin, is there anything else that you wanted to touch on today regarding the work, future projects, the OCHS, really anything at all?
You froze for a minute.
Oh, I was just saying, is there anything else that you'd like to touch on today regarding your work or the OCHS or really anything at all?
I think we've covered everything. It's been terrific talking to you, Raj, and I would just encourage people to explore those courses and your courses. I think your courses are still available for everybody as well. Yes, I mean the Devi Mahatmya is such an important text. Sorry, I got distracted then. You cut that bit out.
That's fine. Yeah, it's a fascinating text. It's, I mean, out of nowhere, you have a Greek goddess text in a tradition that has no shortage of alternate paradigms of religiosity. And so it's the first Greek goddess text in ancient India. And ancient India holds, to my knowledge, the only living Greek goddess tradition from antiquity. I mean, it's astounding. It's astounding. And yet there are a handful of us. Just a teeny number of us studying this text. And I'm like, okay, well, more work for me, I suppose. I've got a couple of decades left to look at it. And here we are.
What do you think of this idea that there are, I mean, there are goddesses in the Rig Veda, aren't there? Is it Kunam Namar or something?
Well, without question, the consort goddesses, the Ushas, the goddess of the dawn, et cetera, et cetera. Without question, we see this all over the Indo-European pantheons, if you will. But this is a very distinct idea versus the ultimate divine being she. I mean, this is not an idea we see anywhere else in the Indic world prior to the Devi Mahatmya. And it's so compelling an idea. And it's been so internalized by Hinduism that there is a sense that there is this Adi Shakti. You know, folks, irrespective of whether they're Shaivas or Vaishnavas or devotees of Rama, you know, for the Navaratri festival, they'll go and they'll worship the mother of creation. And it's sort of this code switching. Okay, all of a sudden now this is Jagaramba. This is the mother of the world. We don't have that idea prior to the Devi Mahatmya. And that idea wouldn't even have entered Sanskritic Brahmanism were it not already in vogue on the ground, one imagines.
I completely agree. That's very interesting. That's just triggered a thought in my own mind. We might be, well, I know we're winding up, but maybe.
No, please. I would love to hear it.
This is... In the tradition called the Krama was a goddess sect, if you like, tantric goddess tradition. And there's a number of texts that they have. And they on the one hand, ritually, they're transgressive, advocating these melikas and these melapas. On the other hand, they've got quite a sophisticated concept, if you like, of the goddess as the sky of consciousness, the Chid Gagana, which we have to become open to the sky of consciousness. And I think that's a wonderful image that of the goddess as the sky. Often she's associated with the earth, but here we've got the goddess as the sky.
Really fascinating. And also, in to my knowledge, all Indo-European symbology, the masculine is the solar and the feminine is the lunar. We see this in Greco-Roman myth, Diana, the moon, Apollo, the sun god. We see this as Lakshmi Narayana. Lakshmi is the water goddess. Vishnu is solar deity. And yet there seems to be this alternate universe, perhaps even much more ancient, where it's reversed, where Shiva is associated with what? The moon. You see the crescent moon in his hair. He's very lunar. And who's more solar than the regal goddess Durga astride her lion, who grants kingship and sovereignty? And there seems to be this fascinating other strand from perhaps beyond or even before Indo-European mythology, where she's the sun and he's the moon, and the implication is the ancients obviously would have understood that the sun's light is being reflected by the moon, and so it really gives a sense of the feminine as primal.
That's right. And in Egypt you've got Nut or Nut, I don't know how to pronounce her name, but she's the sky goddess, you know, arching over.
Yeah, there's a really interesting inversion. And there's also, I think, I believe in Japan and fairly popular solar feminine deity. So it really is fascinating. I think we could talk for hours, but for the sake of our listeners, we better wrap up. It was really a delight speaking with you about the course and the OCHS. Thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you, Raj. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
For those listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Gavin Flood, Professor of Hindu Studies and Comparative Religion at Oxford, one of the tutors and course creators at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, keep reading, keep thinking, and maybe keep contemplating all things tantric, maybe even the Hindu goddess. Bye for now.